Welcome to Mets Clubhouse Confidential. Hope you all had a good week. This is Rich Catino. We got a lot to discuss on tonight's show. We're going to talk about the whole Steve Cohen leaving Twitter story, in which I believe the Met owner was totally right. Twitter, as I call it a lot, is the bathroom wall of America, and I found myself being less on it these days as well, and we'll talk about that. We're also going to rerun a couple of interviews that we did in our premiere show because I've gotten some feedback from people that they want to hear them again. One interview I did with Tom Seaver and another with Ron Swoboda. And then in the final segment of the show, we will talk about the next moves for the Mets and what are the priorities and what are the options as we get closer and closer to what should be the start of spring training. And we'll talk about how that may change as well in the final segment. So we'll be back with talking about the Steve Cohen Twitter story right after this. We'll be back with more of Mets Clubhouse Confidential in a minute. But first I want to talk to you about two of my most favorite things to do. And those of you who know me know this is the case. One is talk sports, and two is eat great Italian food. And I'm going to send you to places where you could do both of those things. First of all, the eating of the Italian food. St. John's of Arthur Avenue in Portchester, on Westchester Avenue in Portchester, right off the 287 Parkway, right up to Westchester Avenue. Go in, say hello to John for me, tell him Bridge sent you, and whatever it is you like. If you like Northern Italian cuisine, it's a great place to eat. If you like Southern Italian cuisine, it's a great place to eat. If you're more of a seafood eater, if you just want a slice of pizza, you want a nice Italian hero, or I'll call it as he calls it, a hoagie. a great place to watch sports too, as the restaurant has an addendum to it now that has a sports bar in there that can watch sports all night long. St. John's of Arthur Avenue. And if you're home and want it delivered to your house in this pandemic world we live in, stjohnsofarthuravenue.com. You can order it online and it'll be at your house before you know it. St. John's of Arthur Avenue. And of course, talking sports. We all love to do it. Anyone who's listening to this show loves to do it as well. And one of the great places to hear about sports, to read about sports, is the number one sports website in New York, thenewyorkextra.com. But it does far more than sports. It covers news and entertainment. And on the sports side, you get your Met stuff from me on it, but you also get so much more. You get coverage of the Knicks and Rangers seasons as they've gotten underway, and how the Jets are going to, what they're going to do with that second pick. In fact, in the coming week, me and Len Robbins are going to have a fierce debate as to what the Jets might do with that second pick. So, thenewyorkextra.com. Log on to it now, and you can talk sports. And if you're doing it from your house at the same time, order food from St. John's of Arthur Avenue. You get a great Italian food in your home, you know, pandemic-free, and you're able to read about sports. TheNewYorkExtra.com and St. John's of Arthur Avenue, a duo that's very hard to beat. You know, Twitter is a good and bad vehicle. I talked a lot about it in the book that I wrote, Press Box Revolution. And one of the things I think Twitter is great at, it's getting, you know, from my perspective, getting my content out there again after it either airs on the radio or is on the New York Extra or even the stuff that I do here on this show. But the comments of Twitter and, you know, it's a tough, tough vehicle to wrap your arms around because, and I'll even put the Cohen stuff to the side for a minute now, but we had a president of our country who used Twitter to get his word out. And whether you agree with it or don't agree with it, as long as it wasn't disrespectful, I think it would have been fine. Once it got to be disrespectful, that's when the social media magnates started to, you know, fact check his tweets. And then they actually closed his tweet account out. And I can tell you from a personal standpoint that I'm very divided on this issue, because I think people have a right to voice their opinions. In fact, when someone has an opinion opposite mine, sometimes I can learn from it. But to be biting and to give personal attacks like the Twitter world gave to Steve Cohen is reprehensible. And the Met owner was totally right in leaving it. And I'll tell you, you know, me personally, I haven't gotten anywhere near the terrible things said to me on Twitter that Steve Cohen got. But I decided to use Twitter less and less. I don't respond to people's tweets. And I'll tell you why. And I think Steve Cohen came to grips with this throughout this last GameStop issue. That if you spend your time on Twitter replying to people that denigrate you, that hate stays in your soul. And it starts to become a passion that you have to refute what people say on Twitter about you or about something you believe in. And that hate just gets emboldened in yourself. And it takes you away from the things that you want to accomplish in your life. And I think people that get on Twitter and castigate others and denigrate others and criticize others, you can be very, very, have a lot of courage behind a keyboard, because you can always just leave the keyboard and go away. And I think that the reason Steve Cohen decided to go on Twitter in the first place was he wanted to interact directly with Met fans. He also wanted to hear some of their suggestions. I think he will continue to hear those suggestions, and he will continue to see those suggestions. But I don't think that it's going to be done through Twitter, and I think that's a wise move. I think that, you know, in most off seasons, if the Mets even did nothing else, to add guys like Francisco Lindor, Carlos Carrasco, Trevor May, that alone is a great addition. And I'll throw Marcus Stroman in there, who was a to-be free agent. So all of those things, I think, are important dynamics to understand what Steve Cohen has already done here. I think Steve Cohen has already lifted the Mets from probably a team that was ranked in the bottom half of their division to a team that's ranked in the top half, if not the top team in their division. In fact, if I was ranking teams in the National League, the only team I'd have ahead of the Mets right now is the Dodgers. And I'd have the Mets neck and neck with the Braves. And now, that can all change if the Mets add someone or if the Braves add someone. You know? So I think that that's one of the things that bothered me about Twitter. Everyone commenting on the Met off-season report card when the classes aren't done, when the final exam hasn't been taken yet. Wait until the entire off-season is over before you denigrate or congratulate the Mets for what they've accomplished. And I think that when Steve Cohen bought the team, because he has a lot of money, people thought that would be the major asset that he would be bringing to the table. And when this GameStop thing all occurred this week, people thought, well, now he's not going to sign a player. Now he's not going to have money to sign. That's why he didn't have money to sign George Springer. Let me explain something so that you all can understand it. George Springer signing would not have been a good move for a number of reasons. And I'm not trying to denigrate him as a player. I think he's going to do great with the Jays. In fact, I think Yankee fans will feel that wrath very early on in the season. But I think that what was going to come down to is, and it wasn't even so much the money, it was the fact that you would have a guy in George Springer with a long-term contract already in place that will eventually need to be put into a corner outfield position in the later years of that contract. Because at his age, it's very difficult to believe that he could play center field for 5 or 6 years. I think he could do it for 2 or 3 years. But I think in the last couple of years of that contract, he's going to have to be in a corner outfield position. And then what do you do with Michael Conforto, who is in his walk year. Could you sign him to a long-term contract and put him in right field, knowing that if you sign Springer, that you eventually will have to put him into right field? And I think the problem I have with fans when they evaluate transactions in the offseason is they look at it as they would a rotisserie baseball season. We have a brand new draft and can pick new players every year. It's not that way. Baseball's not that way. You have to look at it the long term. You have to look at when the players are arbitration eligible. You have to look about how much you have to pay them in those years. And then once they hit the free agent market, you have to realize that you've already established what at least their worth is somewhat in the arbitration settlements. And then you have to pay them appropriately for what the market will bear. My take on the whole thing is I'd rather have Michael Conforto and a unnamed yet center fielder than I would rather have George Springer with an unnamed corner outfielder after this year. Honestly, it comes down to this. I would rather have Michael Conforto than I would rather have George Springer. That's my personal opinion. I could be right. I could be wrong. But I think the Mets look at that. And they also looked at the fact that spending that money might prohibit them from a Francisco Lindor extension, which they must do this season as well. There are three key extensions they have to do. They have to do Conforto, Lindor, and then they have to decide on Noah Syndergaard. And all these things cost money, and for some reason, people thought that the GameStop story would prohibit them from doing anything or adding anybody. And I think fantasy sports is great, and I love playing it too, whether it's football, basketball, hockey, or baseball. But it somehow makes Joe Fan think that being a general manager in sports is easy. It's not. It's a difficult job. There's a reason why there's only 30-some-odd general managers in Major League Baseball. It's a tough job to do, and it gets tougher and tougher every year. And this offseason was particularly tough and will continue to be tough until Major League Baseball decides what it's going to do with certain player with certain things like the DH, for example. And that's another reason why you don't go out and sign Springer right now. You don't know what the DH is going to be. And I see people on Twitter all saying stuff like, well, you can never have enough players. That's a nice, cliche-driven, statement. But you got to have playing time for players. And I'll get to that in the last segment of the show on why that's such a key issue for the Mets and a lot of other teams in the National League as well. When we come back, we'll talk about the greatest Met that ever put on a Met uniform. My conversation with him years ago, George Thomas Seaver, right after this. We'll be back with more of Mets Clubhouse Confidential in a minute. But first, I want to talk to you about two of my most favorite things to do. And those of you who know me know this is the case. One is talk sports, and two is eat great Italian food. And I'm going to send you to places where you could do both of those things. First of all, the eating of the Italian food. St. John's of Arthur Avenue in Portchester, on Westchester Avenue in Portchester, right off the 287 Parkway, right up to Westchester Avenue. Go in. Say hello to John for me. Tell him Rich sent you. And whatever it is you like. If you like Northern Italian cuisine, it's a great place to eat. If you like Southern Italian cuisine, it's a great place to eat. If you're more of a seafood eater, if you just want a slice of pizza, you want a nice Italian hero, or I'll call it as he calls it, a hoagie. a great place to watch sports, too. As the restaurant has an addendum to it now that has a sports bar in there that can watch sports all night long. St. John's of Arthur Avenue. And if you're home and want it delivered to your house in this pandemic world we live in, stjohnsofarthuravenue.com. You can order it online and it'll be at your house before you know it. St. John's of Arthur Avenue. And of course, talking sports. We all love to do it. Anyone who's listening to this show loves to do it as well. And one of the great places to hear about sports, to read about sports, is the number one sports website in New York, the NewYorkExtra.com. But it does far more than sports. It covers news and entertainment. And on the sports side, you get your Mets stuff from me on it, but you also get so much more. You get coverage of the Knicks and Rangers seasons as they've gotten underway. And how the Jets are what they're going to do with that second pick. In fact, in the coming week, me and Len Robbins are going to have a fierce debate as to what the Jets might do with that second pick. The NewYorkExtra.com. We are back on Mets Clubhouse Confidential. And, you know, when you talk about Tom Seaver and when you talk about him to young Met fans, you know, young Met fans live through the Matt Harvey days and the excitement of Jacob DeGrom taking the mound, and all those things were great to be around. In my early reporting years, I saw what Shea Stadium was like when Doc Gooden pitched, and those were great moments too. But in reality, growing up in the Bronx, the days or nights Tom Seaver pitched were great days being a Met fan in the Bronx. It were days where no other sports really mattered. It didn't matter what the football teams were doing in the offseason. It didn't matter what the basketball and hockey teams were doing in town, and it certainly didn't matter what the team across the river was doing. Number 41 took the mound. It was a block party every single time. And I think Seaver was as professional on the mound as anyone I've ever seen. And the other part of it is, and I know Yankee fans aren't going to like what I'm about to say, the greatest pitcher to ever toe the rubber in New York sports history is George Thomas Seaver. And yeah, I do think his numbers dictate that, but he changed a whole franchise from a franchise that people joked about to a franchise people adored. And I think that, you know, my initial show, I ran an interview I did with Tom Seaver. I'm going to rerun that now because I've gotten so much feedback that people want to hear it again. So here it is, the time I spent with Tom Seaver on the last day Shea Stadium ever hosted a baseball game, the last day of the season in 2008.
Tom, when you think about 1969, what comes to your mind first?
I think it's a matter of emotion and stuff. I don't think there's so many wonderful things that happen. And at one moment, could it be one thing? At one moment, it could be another. It was the imperfect game, or winning the World Championship, or just seeing Swoboda and AG making catches. I mean, there's so many things that are pictures that will last forever, that whatever the moment is, you just, it could be something that just obviously brings back a smile and wonderful memories.
What was it like to play with Gil Hodges? You're such a strong and professional man.
Well, Gil was the most important man of my professional career, about how learning how to be a professional and how you go about your business, because he demanded that. And Gil was, he demanded it by sometimes just simply walking in a room. And he was a Marine. We kind of had that joint union. And the disciplines that go on in the Marine Corps, I think, which he brought to the table, which I fully understood. But there's just too many things. He was too many things that happened with Gil, and in many ways, not enough things because of his, you know, premature death. But I think the most importantly, taught me how to be a professional. This is how you go about your business. Not 150 games a year, not 40 games a year, 162 games a year. Every time you put on that uniform, and that's just like putting on a Marine Corps uniform. There is a demand for excellence and a demand for performance.
Now, 4 years later, you guys get to the World Series again.
Yeah.
What do you remember that run? Is that the five games against the Pirates that you played late in the year with the pennant on the line?
It was all such a bit of, we were out of it, but nobody would win it, and we got there. And getting to the World Series is the consummate goal other than winning the World Series. You want to get there. You want your year to be fruitful. And in many ways, I think about the playoffs with the Reds even more than I do, because they were one hell of a team. And not to say that that Oakland A club was not good, but that Cincinnati Red team with the number of Hall of Famers and potential Hall of Famers they had on that club, that was one hell of a team.
Now, when you came to this, or you came to the Mets, you know, the Mets were in a town where the Yankees had dominated for quite some time, and you guys wrested it from them. I mean, did you ever think of that stuff when it was going on?
No. You're trying to get to the big leagues. You're trying to, you know, we're making $7,000 a year, not $7,000 a pitch, you know, and we were trying to establish ourselves, you can say, in the big leagues. This is, you know, going to be, this was a, more than anything else, for a period of time, it was a job, you know. It allowed you to be independent, to get married, to start your own life and stuff, but it was a job.
Thanks so much for taking out the time and talking to us, Tom. Always great to see you.
My pleasure. Good to see all you guys. Thanks.
George Thomas Seaver. Not only a great player, but a great person. And someone who put baseball in my soul very early on in my life and put it there in indelible ink. And for that, I'll always be grateful. We'll be back with our chat with Ron Swoboda on Met Clubhouse Confidential right after this. We'll be back with more of Mets Clubhouse Confidential in a minute. But first, I want to talk to you about two of my most favorite things to do. And those of you who know me know this is the case. One is talk sports, and two is eat great Italian food. And I'm going to send you to places where you could do both of those things. First of all, the eating of the Italian food. St. John's of Arthur Avenue in Portchester, on Westchester Avenue in Portchester, right off the 287 Parkway, right up to Westchester Avenue. Go in, say hello to John for me, tell him Bridge sent you, and whatever it is you like. If you like Northern Italian cuisine, it's a great place to eat. If you like Southern Italian cuisine, it's a great place to eat. If you're more of a seafood eater, if you just want a slice of pizza, you want a nice Italian hero, or I'll call it as he calls it, a hoagie. A great place to watch sports, too, as the restaurant has an addendum to it now that has a sports bar in there that can watch sports all night long. St. John's of Arthur Avenue. And, of course, talking sports. We all love to do it. Anyone who's listening to this show loves to do it as well. And one of the great places to hear about sports, to read about sports, is the number one sports website in New York, thenewyorkextra.com. But it does far more than sports. It covers news and entertainment. And on the sports side, you get your Met stuff from me on it, but you also get so much more. You get coverage of the Knicks and Rangers seasons as they've gotten underway. And how the Jets are going to, what they're going to do with that second pick. The second interview I did on my initial show here was one with Ron Swoboda, which I'm about to replay. And one of the things I think people need to remember about Ron Swoboda is he is so illustrative of the history of the Met franchise. He came to the Mets as a young prospect that, as Casey Stengel once said, I think you'll find that Ron Swoboda could hit the ball over buildings. But he had his issues. He had his issues in the outfield. He had his issues running the bases. He had his issues with strikeouts when the home runs didn't come. He went from being a prospect in the mid-60s to being someone that fans were a little disappointed with. And then when Gil Hodges came to manage the team in 1968, and he brought his platoon philosophy with him, it helped Ron Swoboda out a lot. And Ron had his bouts with Gil. But one of the things that I think made Gil special was he didn't hold any favorites in what he was holding players accountable for doing. I mean, Cleon Jones was a star of a team, and he didn't hustle after a ball. And Gil walked laboriously out to left field and took him out of a game in 1969. He wouldn't put up with that no matter who the player was. And in the last years of Tommy Agee's life, I talked to him about Gil, and he said, I would have never done what I did in 69 if Gil didn't hang tough with me in 68 when I had a struggling year. And I think in a lot of ways, Swoboda symbolized that transfer of success. Because even though he was in only a, quote, platoon position, he was a big reason why the Mets won the World Series. He had that two-home run game in the night Steve Carlton struck out 19 Mets and still lost the game to the Mets in September of 69. And then we all know about the catch he made in Game 4. And I talk about that with Ron, and I also talk about him, about the allure of playing with Tom Seaver and playing for Gil Hodges. And here's that interview with Ron Swoboda.
Ron, you know, when you talk about that 69 season, was there a period of time during the season where you said, this is really clicking in here? Is there a period of time? Was it the Cubs series in the middle of the season?
Well, we always played good against the Cubs. It certainly wasn't when we played against the Astros, who beat us 10 out of 12 that year. But I think early on when we were flopping around 500 into June, and we started a series in Shea and then went on the West Coast. And we played those West Coast teams pretty good, all three of them. And we rolled through about 11 straight wins. And I think the team went, maybe we got something here with all those young arms. And that's when they made the deal for Clendenin. That's when they traded Steve Renko and three other guys, Kevin Collins and those guys, and Clendenin came in here. That's when I think they started taking the, you know, our management took us seriously, and from that point on, we were a little different club, and we had gone, you know, by the time we had gone through the league twice, we felt like, wow, we're competitive. We can play with everybody but the Astros. We didn't have to beat the Astros like the Cubs. Cubs were in our division. And we played some really solid series against them, really tough series against them. And I think, you know, it really wasn't until the end of August, 1st of September, when we ran them down. They augured a little bit, and we were on cruise control and turbo. And blew by them in early September, and that's when we rolled by them and never looked back.
Gil Hodges, what was it like being around him and everything he represented?
You know, Gil could simplify things that a lot of managers could make complex. I think if you manage to a simple idea, then, you know, it's like a good jazz player. You know, you resolve something that's pretty complex in a simple way, and it comes through your, it hits your ears in a way you understand it. You don't need to know all the workings, why it works. You just know it sounds good. Well, he did things on a baseball diamond that played well, that we understood, and he would do some interesting, creative things. You know, put four outfielders out there, or bring in me to play first base and dare a pitcher to bunt in a situation. He never was behind the game. Hodges really understood what he wanted to do all the time, and you were aware of the fact that, you know, you didn't have to worry about your manager getting behind the play at all, ever.
I want to talk about a couple of performances you had. One in September, in a game which Steve Carlton struck out 19 batters, and you went yard on him twice. What was that like, Ron? I mean, you hit him well?
You know, I didn't really. Who hit him well? I don't know who hit him well. I didn't hit him well. I think I got that and about two singles off him, and that was the extent of it. But you know, it was a funny thing. We were playing in St. Louis, the old ballpark, the second iteration of Busch Stadium, and they had a machine in left field, and I asked Ralph Kiner if he'd feed me some balls through this wheel machine down there. I said, I'm just not feeling right, you know, and we didn't have anything like hitting coaches and stuff like back then. They were around, but we didn't really feature any. Yogi, you know, and Yogi knew how to hit,
right?
But I'm not sure he could tell you how to hit. You know, Yogi might say something like, if you can't hit it, don't swing at it. And you'd go, what about two strikes, Yogi? Well, then you might have to swing at it. You know, it's like, well, all right, thank you for clearing that up. And that's a joke, but Yogi knew how to hit. You know, he was a good bad ball hitter and a better good ball hitter. And so, but, it, you know, we didn't have coaches as such, but Ralph went out there with me, got permission, and fed me some balls, and just looked at me and said, "How's that feel? You hit that one good? Yeah. Try your hands here. All right, good. All right, ready? And, you know, and just looked at you and gave you some feedback. And I got in a good space. And, you know, here you go up against a guy who's got great stuff. And, you know, I banged him twice in a game where he was as good as he was ever in his career. And he struck out 19. That was a record in the major leagues. And he had me two strikes when I hit the home run and struck me out twice. So it could have been nothing. And it turns out to be one of the best games I ever had.
Another thing in that September, you guys had a doubleheader against the Pirates where you won 2-1-0 games where the pitcher drove in each run. I mean, do you start to think that you're blessed when you see something like that?
I don't know about blessed, but something's working for you. You know, I think we had great pitching, and we felt like our pitching could keep us in ball games. And, you know, you get two games like that and in a doubleheader, and Don Cardwell goes five innings and drives in the go-ahead run, and then Koosman went nine with a shutout and drove in the only run, and you win that game, and you go, you know, this is getting scary because it all seems possible.
And now, getting to the actual World Series with the Orioles, something Buddy had said to me years ago where Buford leads off with a home run, and as Buford's running around
that
second,
I should have caught you in right field.
That's right, you came close to it.
No, I should have caught it. I didn't play it well. I was so damn nervous, I thought I almost broke myself.
But Buddy said as Buford's running past him, Buford looked at him and said, ah, home run. Buddy said, well, first...
No, he said, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Yes.
And Buddy said, I didn't know what to say to him. Like, he said, I'd love to have thought of saying, well, you ain't seen nothing yet either. But he said, I couldn't get it out.
That's great stuff. And then when you guys get back here, you know, I've talked to Earl Weaver, you know...
Well, we split with them in Baltimore. And I think, here's the thing you better keep in mind. The Orioles played in the American League, and we played in the National League. And I think the National League, depth-wise, in terms of talent, was a notch or two above the American League. That doesn't mean their best team can't beat our best team. But I think we came through a tougher test to win the National League. And so there was a golden opportunity for the Orioles not to take us lightly, but to look at them and go, am I glad it's them?
Right.
Without knowing us and without knowing what we've been through.
And then no conversation would be complete without talking about the catch in game four. It's a tight game. Seaver's on the mound. Brooks Robinson at the plate. Take us through what was going through your mind as that line drive was coming towards you.
Well, I had taken thousands of balls in the outfield because I had made such a mess of it so many times. If anybody's ever, you know, you forget what Shea Stadium looked like, but if you look up at the top of these lights here at Citi Field, and this is a beautiful place with architecture galore. The architecture at Shea Stadium, it was like a big globe theater on triple deck. It was a high stadium where a lot of balls never get out of the seats. And where, you know, if the lighting is odd and you're not sure yourself, I made a mess of it. So I worked with Eddie Yost, got me on the end of the fungo bat, and he hit me from about 150 feet, line drives and ground balls, left, right, over my head, in front of me. I wanted to work on reading the ball off the bat. You read the ball right off the bat, things are going to get better for you right away. And that's what I worked on. Worked on my footwork in the outfield. You're catching the ball also every time. And I played it all, practiced it all at speed. It wasn't tra-la-la. It was at game speed. Otherwise, what are you doing? And I got better. I wanted Hodges not to put Rod Gasper in as a defensive replacement. It drove me crazy that he did it. I understood why. I wanted him to look and go, I don't think I need to do that move. And he did, finally.
And he didn't do that move, and lucky for him he didn't, because then he had Gaspar to pinch run right to score the winning run. Now, when you talk about after that World Series is over.
You're good with your history now. Okay.
When you talk about the World Series and it's over now and you have the parade and stuff, what is that like for those of us that have never experienced anything like that as a professional? What is that like?
You felt like the biggest deal in the Big Apple. And for a while there, you felt like... The other thing was you felt gratified that you had given the city something. And you had given these fans who had followed you from those 100 lost seasons, you'd given them a present. And to ride down the street in a convertible and everybody's got a grin on their face, and you felt like, well, I had something to do with putting it there. And that was a great time, because don't forget, we had a lot of social unrest and the war in Vietnam and, all kinds of identity politics going on then, gay rights going on, women's rights, civil rights, and anti-war stuff that was pretty angry. And in the midst of all of that, there was this guy that went up on the moon, Neil Armstrong, and maybe something even less predictable, the Mets win a World Series. Holy mackerel.
And one final question for you. You know, when you look at, when I looked at that team as a young kid, and I first started following the Mets in like 67, when Seaver came to me, that was one thing that kind of changed things. And when Hodges came, that was the second thing that changed it. You being around for before, during, and after, is that pretty right?
Look, I think in that year when they picked up Clendenin and gave us another bat in the lineup with some power, Seaver came to us in 67. And Tom Seaver was the Tom Seaver that went to the Hall of Fame. From day one, there wasn't any this little kid's got to get his feet on the ground and used to pitch in the big league. There wasn't any of that. Tom Seaver showed up, and he was Tom Seaver from day one. There wasn't any break-in period, and all he had to do was stay healthy and accumulate the numbers, and he's going to the Hall of Fame. And Kuzman, obviously, I think that was a big one, and then every that whole pitching staff, really. But we were also a pretty good defensive team, and Hodges just made good moves and made you used his people in a way that kept everybody ready. Platooning, you know, it's wonderful if you've got good options, because you keep everybody ready, and you want to play guys in the second game of a doubleheader, and they haven't played in 5 days. Well, you know, you're not as smart when guys aren't ready to play. Hodges kept everybody ready to go.
Thank you for your time, and you're always going to be a name that Met fans love forever. Understand that, please.
There ain't no forever at my age.
Ron Swoboda. And I'll tell you, I've had a lot of interviews with Ron, and one of the great things about him is there's always a smile on your face after the interview. We'll be back with our final segment to talk about the next steps for the Mets and the things baseball has to decide in order to help the Mets make those decisions right after this. We'll be back with more of Mets Clubhouse Confidential in a minute. But first, I want to talk to you about two of my most favorite things to do. And those of you who know me know this is the case. One is talk sports, and two is eat great Italian food. And I'm going to send you to places where you could do both of those things. First of all, the eating of the Italian food. St. John's of Arthur Avenue in Portchester, on Westchester Avenue in Portchester, right off the 287 Parkway, right up to Westchester Avenue. Go in, say hello to John for me, tell him Bridge sent you, and whatever it is you like. If you like Northern Italian cuisine, it's a great place to eat. If you like Southern Italian cuisine, it's a great place to eat. If you're more of a seafood eater, if you just want a slice of pizza, you want a nice Italian hero, or I'll call it as he calls it, a hoagie. a great place to watch sports too, as the restaurant has an addendum to it now that has a sports bar in there that can watch sports all night long. St. John's of Arthur Avenue. And if you're home and want it delivered to your house in this pandemic world we live in, stjohnsofarthuravenue.com. You can order it online and it'll be at your house before you know it. St. John's of Arthur Avenue. And of course, talking sports. We all love to do it. Anyone who's listening to this show loves to do it as well. And one of the great places to hear about sports, to read about sports, is the number one sports website in New York, thenewyorkextra.com. But it does far more than sports. It covers news and entertainment. And on the sports side, you get your Met stuff from me on it, but you also get so much more. You get coverage of the Knicks and Rangers seasons as they've gotten underway. and how the Jets are going to, what they're going to do with that second pick. In fact, in the coming week, me and Len Robbins are going to have a fierce debate as to what the Jets might do with that second pick. So, the NewYorkExtra.com. Log on to it now, and you can talk sports. And if you're doing it from your house at the same time, order food from St. John's of Arthur Avenue. You get a great Italian food in your home, you know, pandemic-free, and you're able to read about sports. TheNewYorkExtra.com and St. John's of Arthur Avenue, a duo that's very hard to beat. We are back on Mets Clubhouse Confidential, and as the Mets explore what their next steps are in the offseason, I will tell you this right now, that the Mets are right now, to me, co-favorites with the Braves in the NL East, even if they do nothing else this season. And one of the things that we talked about was, in the previous weeks, is how the Mets needed a lefty in the bullpen. And they needed a lefty in the bullpen, and they didn't get the one they wanted. Brad Hand actually went to the Nationals, and people were all saying, how can the Mets get outbid by the Nationals? The Mets weren't outbid by the Nationals. They were outbid by the role Brad Hand was promised to the Nationals. Mets couldn't promise Brad Hand that he would close games. And they could promise him that he would be in a competition to close games, that he'd be in the mix of closing games, but they couldn't promise him that he'd be the primary closer. And he signed with the Nationals. And we'll have to see where the Mets go from here. And we know they signed Aaron Loop to a contract, and I think he's someone that will definitely fit that role of a left-handed reliever in the bullpen. And let's not forget that the Mets signed Jerry Blevins to a minor league deal, and he's another option, potentially, that could come up during the season and help out if they need another lefty in the bullpen. But I also think what the Loop signing does is it could fill the Met bullpen out without having Seth Lugo in it from the start of the season. If the Mets decide in their search for a starting pitcher that they can't get to an agreement with Trevor Bauer, and there's another option out there in Jake Arrieta that I think the Mets will consider as well. But let's assume for a minute the Mets don't get either of those players. Well then, because of what you've added in the bullpen, you could think about Seth Lugo in that rotation until Noah Syndergaard's ready to come back, and then maybe at that point you put Lugo in the bullpen. Or you go out and get another starting pitcher, you know. And as far as the Trevor Bauer stuff is concerned, I know the Mets have a lot to consider, and obviously money is a big consideration. Do you give him a 1 or 2 year deal for a tremendous amount of money? It's not an easy decision to say yes or no to. But I think this stuff that I'm hearing about his off-the-field, let's just say, consternation is totally overblown. Yes, again, we're going to come to the top option of Twitter. And my sense of it is, Trevor Bauer, if he comes to the Mets or any team he goes to, should do far less on Twitter than he's doing now. And there's this talk that he had a debate with someone on Twitter and disrespected her, etc. I can tell you this about baseball players. They don't entrust people to be their agents that they think are fly-by-nights, that they think they don't trust. Trevor Bauer has a female agent. She's a terrific agent. And that's got to tell you everything you need to know about Trevor Bauer and his feelings about that issue. I don't know Trevor Bauer. I've never interviewed him. I've never met him. I've, you know, been on Zoom calls after games and stuff like that in the press conference setting. But I've never done one-on-ones with him. I don't know him well. But I do know when I see him pitch that he's one of the top five pitchers in the National League, if not higher than that. So I look at this and I say, okay, the money's an issue, and if they don't sign him and it's money-wise doesn't work, I can totally understand that. But if you get him, you're the best team in the National League. I mean, when you think about a starting rotation of Jacob DeGrom, Trevor Bauer, Marcus Stroman, Carlos Carrasco, David Peterson, that quintet is the best in baseball. When you think about then Seth Lugo going into a bullpen that already has Edwin Diaz and already has, you know, Trevor May, and already has a Familian of Betances, hopefully they can rebound. That's a tremendous bullpen, and throw Aaron Loop in there too. The lineup, I thought, coming into this season was good enough to win the division. By that I mean coming into the offseason. And with Francisco Lindor, it's even better. Now, the next gift Met fans are going to want is a center fielder. Now, they could sign a Jackie Bradley Jr., but I think one of the reasons everyone's waiting to sign someone like that is, will there be a DH in the National League? And it's a big thing for the Mets, because if there is no DH and you get a center fielder like a Jackie Bradley Jr., for instance, how do you – you probably have to move Nimmo to left. How do you get at bats for Dominic Smith? How do you get bats for Jose Martinez? But if there is a DH and you get the center fielder, Dominic Smith could be a DH one day, or Pete Alonso could be a DH. Jose Martinez could play first when Alonso's DHing. Dominic Smith can play left, and Jose Martinez can play left a little bit too. There are things you can do with the lineup. J.D. Davis can play left or third base. You could put Guillermo at third and J.D. Davis at left and say D.H. Dominic Smith on days. You could really start to build your team that way. But if you don't have a D.H., many of those players I just mentioned are going to be bench players, players that spell other players on days when they're off and come off the bench to pinch hit. And I just don't think that's making great use of a guy like Dominic Smith. So if there's no DH, you have to almost think about putting Brandon Nimmo in center and then using left field in the same way you would, you know, if you had a center fielder. And I think that to me is an important aspect of all of this. If you have no DH and you go out and get a center fielder and you still want Brandon Nimmo in the lineup, your decision is going to come down to, is Nimmo playing left? Is Dominic Smith playing left? And whoever's not playing it, they're on the bench. Whereas with the DH, you got another landing spot for that. And I see people on Twitter saying all the time, it's never a problem to get players at bats. In a DH setting, I totally agree with that. But in the setting of a non-DH, that could be an issue. And Major League Baseball has done a terrible job of negotiating this with players. I think that the DH needs to be in the National League. The other thing Major League Baseball has done a really poor job on is how many playoff teams are there going to be? And I think that's somewhat connected to the negotiation for a universal DH. If we're going back to the, you know, situation where the three division winners and two wild cards make the playoffs, it could be a much different roster configuration than if, like last year, more teams than that made the playoffs. So you definitely have to start to figure out the best way to do your off-season planning and your off-season roster construction with two variables that could change everything in a New York minute. And I don't think the Mets are going to sign a Jackie Bradley Jr. type until they decide what's going on with the DH. The other thing is the start of the season. And listen, we know 2020 had to be done the way it was done because of a pandemic. I got a newsflash for you. We're still in a pandemic. And until that vaccination gets out to baseball players and even fans to a certain extent, and is proven to be compatible with everything in your body, and we're not going to know that until the rounds of vaccinations are really completed, then and only then can we figure out when to start the season. I think for pitchers and catchers to report in mid-February is a terrible idea. Terrible idea for Florida. It's a terrible idea for Arizona. I've said this on numerous occasions. I think what I would do is, knowing the season started July 1st last year, and it was 60 games, instead what I would do is I would start the season either, you know, June 1st or maybe Memorial Day weekend, and play 100 games. So now the players are getting more money than they got last year. Being as though it's starting on June 1st with 100 games, there may be more of a chance that fans could come in the stands, at least in some kind of a truncated version. And that will put money in the owners' pockets. And then the Universal DH will put more money in the players' pockets, because that's another big contract that's needed for every National League team to address their DH, as opposed to having as the 25th player sitting on the bench most nights. And the playoff structure that was used last year gets used again this year, which is going to provide more TV revenue for Major League Baseball owners, and it's going to provide more of a chance for players to go deeper into the playoffs and show their worth. When you think about last year's playoff run, so many people now know about the core players of the Tampa Rays that they didn't know 2 years ago. And I think that it will benefit everybody. So if you start the year on June 1st, you play a 100-game schedule, which means you play 25 games a month for those 4 months, June, July, August, and September. And you still have 5 or 6 off days in those months to combat travel and just the teams need, you know, days off. And you start spring training in early to mid-April, and you start it like you did the second wave last year in the home parks. Now, Boston could be a problem in April with weather. By mid-April, it should be okay, but who knows? Any of the northern cities could be an issue. Obviously, it could be an issue in Buffalo, where Toronto's going to have to play. You might have to make adjustments there. But I think for preseason games, you can play them, and maybe you could start to kind of figure out how many fans you might let in the ballpark. Maybe you let 100 fans in and spread them out in the lower deck, in the, you know, box seats at Citi Field or Yankee Stadium. But I think you don't have teams travel too much for preseason games. Maybe you cut down the preseason games to maybe 10 to 15 games, and you make the Mets play the Yankees a bunch, and the Red Sox a bunch, and the Phillies a bunch, and the Yankees the same thing. You know, teams that are generally in their zones, because everyone's not going to be in one state at spring training. They're going to be in different states. So for the Mets, for example, you can create a 15-game schedule where they play Phillies some, they play the Pirates some, they play the Nationals some, and they play the Yankees some, obviously, maybe even the Red Sox. And you look at it, and then you make your preseason schedule that way. For your regular season schedule, you make them play more teams in their own division. They'll still have the interleague within the division. But maybe you could sprinkle a game or so with teams out of the division, as long as it's not across the country. And these are all things baseball has to decide. It has to decide soon. And I simply don't know what the delay is. And Rob Manfred has to sit down with Tony Clark and they have to negotiate this face-to-face, man-to-man. And each of them's got to give up something. That's what negotiations are. And hopefully by the time we're on next week, we'll know more about spring training and we'll know more about, you know, what the next steps are. But to me, to start a season on April 1st and open up spring training in mid-February in Florida and Arizona makes absolutely no sense to me. I didn't like the 60-game season because it was less than half the schedule. That was scheduled games that were scheduled to be played. I think you get to a 100-game season in a four-month period, that's more palatable to me because it's more than half a season and it's close to, you know, 60 to 70% of the games you would have played. And we're still in a pandemic. We still have to be very careful. We still have to try to get normalcy back. But I think fan entry into the ballpark is important, A, for the fans, B, for the players, and C, of course, for the owners. So that would be my plan going forward. That's about all the time we have for on Mets Clubhouse Confidential. I'm Rich Catino. Have a great week all. See you next Sunday.